I appreciate the opportunity to introduce our expert trainers. All of them have been active members of the ITRC's Remediation Management of Complex Sites team over the years. Not only do they serve as volunteer trainers for ITRC, they dedicated many hours to developing the guidance that they are going to talk you through today. If you'd like to read more about any of their expertise, you can find their bios on the CLUIN training page. And at this time, I am going to pause to move over and introduce Susan Newton with Colorado.
Thanks, Nicole. So what is the challenge at complex sites, and why was this guidance written? Okay, I'm going to move the screen over. Thank you. So as we all know, Superfund was enacted in 1980, and it was a response to some hazardous waste management practices that were once common practice, but an understatement is that they were somewhat naive, and they left a significant legacy of environmental contamination to the nation's soils and groundwater and surface water and even air. So now, as a profession, we have about 40 years of experience addressing environmental remediation sites like this. But at some of these sites, complete remediation is still a fairly significant challenge. In many cases, there isn't any longer an immediate risk to human health and the environment, but it might be decades or even longer to actually reach regulatory standards. And then at other sites, making progress towards remediation might be uncertain. Each site is unique. And sometimes the challenges might be complicated and varied enough that we might actually wonder if anyone's ever even solved problems like this. So as an ITRC team, we came up with the following description of a complex site. And the description is that it's a site where remediation progress is uncertain and remediation isn't expected to achieve closure or even long-term management within a reasonable time frame. And, you know, I understand that reasonable time frame is a bit subjective, but generally speaking, that's on the order of decades. So there was a poll that was presented when people were signing in, which highlights some of the examples of challenges that we face at complex sites. Nicole, can you bring the poll up? Yes. I'm sorry, Nicole, I can't actually see the poll. I'm going to move on to the next site, or to the next slide.
Great, Susan. We do have the poll up. Information is coming in. I will end the poll here in 1 minute, and or just a couple of seconds, and let the audience see it, but you can go ahead and move on to the next slide.
All right, thanks. So our guidance has 16 case studies that are presented in the guidance. And you may find those very useful. Here's two examples of complex sites. The first photo, this is an aerial view of the Rocky Flats site in Colorado. It was a Department of Energy facility. It's 10 square miles, and it was used for manufacturing parts for nuclear weapons. My understanding is that it was manufacturing triggers for nuclear weapons. The cleanup cost $7 billion, and it was completed in October 2005. At the time, it was the largest environmental cleanup of a surplus site in the nation. And so the case study that is in our guidance document features remediation efforts at just one of what are actually four groundwater plumes at the site. And they came from some solar evaporation ponds that were used to store some low-level radioactive waste and some other waste as well. The commingled plumes covered over 50 acres. The second photo shows an investigation work into a residential area in California that was affected by vapor intrusion and some groundwater contamination that was downgradient of the Moffett Field / Millfield Ellis Wiseman, also known as MEW sites in California. This site's really complex. It's complex because it had multiple source areas. There were multiple responsible parties. There were commingled plumes, 8 aquifer zones, geologic heterogeneities, several exposure pathways, and all of this was in a residential land use area. So quite a complex site indeed. Nationwide, there is a lot of interest in complex sites, but there isn't much guidance, or there wasn't much guidance for tackling these challenges. The ITRC team was formed partly in response to a National Research Council report that estimated that at least 10% of the sites in the nation are considered to be complex, and that the cost to complete those was estimated at $127 billion. And then by 2017, the GAO reported that the estimated environmental liability from the federal government alone was more like $465 billion. And so consciousness was kind of raised about the issue of complex sites, but there was a lot of disparate guidance and not sort of a comprehensive guidance that allowed for a clear approach. So that clearly there was a need for additional guidance that was targeted for complex sites specifically. And so this ITRC guidance, this ITRC group was formed, and the ITRC guidance was written, and it was written for state regulators, site owners, representatives, and other stakeholders that that are involved with complex sites. It was a large team and had about 200 members. At the time, it was the largest one that ITRC had. I think the PFAS team is now a bit larger than that, though. And what this guidance does is it presents a recommended process for remediation management at complex sites. And that process is termed adaptive site management, and it's really a key takeaway from this guidance. And you'll hear the term adaptive site management repeated frequently throughout the training. The guidance does incorporate and refers to some best management practices and existing tools and technologies that are described by EPA and DOD and some others. And as I mentioned before, there are 16 case studies in the site. And very importantly, stakeholder perspectives are addressed and summarized in the guidance itself. So this slide provides a roadmap to today's training, and it follows the organization of the guidance itself. So following this introduction, we'll talk about some site challenges. That's chapter 2 of the guidance. Chapter 3 covers remediation potential assessments. Chapter 4, adaptive remedy selection, and long-term management is in chapter 5. And then also the guidance does move on to stakeholder perspectives and training in chapters 6 and 7. And so the flowchart overall shows the adaptive site management process, and the color coding does correspond to each chapter where the steps in adaptive site management are discussed in detail. And just a real brief view or a sense of what adaptive site management means. It's a comprehensive and flexible iterative process that's pretty well suited for complex sites, especially where there's significant uncertainty in remedial approach against. Essentially what it does is it's a technique that allows you to periodically evaluate and adjust the remedial approach against some interim objectives. It might involve multiple technologies at any time, and might incorporate changes in technological approaches over time. So what can we accomplish using adaptive site management at complex sites? It probably goes without saying it doesn't actually offer shortcuts or a means to avoid site remediation. Obviously, the number one priority is to continue to maintain protection of human health and the environment and fulfill all regulatory requirements. But adaptive site management does improve site decisions and helps to streamline decision making. And this can decrease remediation costs in the long term and also potentially decrease some remediation timeframes. It's a process by which it can help establish some milestones that will demonstrate some interim progress that eventually will lead to the long-term goal. Also, because it's an iterative process, it may reduce potential technical, regulatory, procedural barriers that can sometimes crop up at these sites. And especially for technologies that are infrequently practiced, it sometimes can encourage returning all or part of the site to beneficial reuse earlier in the remediation life cycle, recognizing that additional time might be needed to achieve some overall site objectives. There's a case study in the guidance for a Naval Air Station in Jacksonville, Florida. We like this one because it specifically calls out adaptive site management by name. Some of the other ones kind of use the concept, but don't really, focus on the site managers didn't call it out by name. In this case, they actually did. What happened at this site was that the conceptual site model was refined after an interim remedial action was underway. And so there was a new conceptual site model that was developed. And this was made possible by some pilot studies that were conducted after the interim action had been going for a while. And that additional site characterization allowed the site to move to some more risk-based remediation approach that was supported by the pilot studies and greatly increased the efficiency of the cleanup at this site. Throughout the guidance, what's really emphasized is stakeholder engagement, and ITRC absolutely highly recommend and emphasize enough the value of stakeholders, especially in complex sites. Stakeholders may include all groups and individuals that are potentially impacted by the project. And so at complex sites particularly, there might be multiple stakeholder groups and usually a pretty long site history to take into account. Chapter 7 really speaks strongly to stakeholder perspectives and concerns at complex sites. And it also includes some best practices for involving stakeholders. Overall, we recommend involving stakeholders early, building trust, fostering respect, and it really can't be understated how well that can improve the quality of decisions at the sites. The ITRC group that wrote this guidance also had stakeholders as part of the group itself. And so one of the case studies that is in the guidance was nominated by the stakeholders in the group. And it's the MEW site that I had referred to earlier in California. One of the interesting and unique things about this site is that the stakeholders kind of became part and parcel of the remedy themselves by recommending that local zoning and permitting requirements address the vapor intrusion problems that were at the site. And so this case study is a really good example of how stakeholders can improve remediation process. So by the end of the training, you should be able to identify and integrate the technical and the non-technical challenges to remediation of complex sites. You should be able to use the remediation potential assessment in Chapter 3 to identify whether the adaptive site management is in fact warranted at your site. You should be able to understand and apply adaptive site management principles and develop a long-term performance-based plan. You should be able to identify some well-demonstrated techniques for stakeholder engagement and access some additional resources and tools. In the remaining sections of the training, what we'll be discussing is remediation potential assessment. And then there will be some questions and answers and adaptive remedy selection, long-term management, and we'll prepare you to take some action. There will be questions and answers throughout the roadmap, throughout the training today. And that will give more opportunity to sort of digest and discuss what we're presenting today in the training. So now I'd like to turn it over to Roy, my colleague Roy Fun from GHD Consulting.
Great. Thanks, Susan. Appreciate that. Good introduction. So I'm going to be talking about Chapter 2, the site challenges. This is where we're talking about both technical and non-technical challenges. It's really those challenges that inform the conceptual site model and that really make a site complex. I'm hoping that I'll be able to help improve your awareness about these challenges and how they really can affect and influence the path of a site remedy. Later on, you're going to learn how to quantify these challenges and create a holistic adaptive site management plan that Susan had mentioned. So let's go on next to talking about a complex site. You know, what is a complex site? Well, here we're showing the Tri-State Mining District site. It's 2,500 square miles and has widespread contaminated soil, groundwater, and surface water. So my question is, you know, would you consider this to be a complex site? Well, of course, most people would just based on the size. But I'm hoping that what you're going to realize through my discussion here and through reading the guidance in general is that size is just one factor that can make up a site's complexity. Now, Susan had mentioned the definition of a complex site. I don't need the poll just yet, Nicole. Thank you. So the team actually spent weeks debating this definition. See, we all kind of know that remediation is inherently difficult, right? Even at a simple site. And what we want to do is recognize that, you know, there's these technical and non-technical challenges really can affect a site, and identifying these challenges can help improve that conceptual site model and the remedy effectiveness. The important point here is that complex site, you know, that really, those are just words. What I want to emphasize here is that the key consideration may be, I'll put may, up to your own interpretation, the emphasis on reasonable time frame that you see in the definition. So with that, I want to bring up the poll now, Nicole, and ask our audience what they believe is a reasonable time frame, meaning, you know, which remediation timeframe do you think usually makes for a complex site? And you can see your options, right? Greater than 10 years, greater than 30 years, greater than 60 years, greater than 100 years, or timeframe does not determine site complexity. So I'll give you an opportunity to take a minute and think about that and click on your answer, and then we'll take a look at your results. All right, Nicole, let's see what we can bring up the results. Interesting. Okay, so we had the majority of folks said that it does not determine the site complexity, with the next being greater than 30 years. We can go ahead and close that now, Nicole. Thank you much. So we also polled our state representatives during our development of our guidance. We asked them the same question. Professionals that are working with states in their environmental programs. And here's what they said. They agreed with you, the majority, right, that the remedial timeframe does not determine site complexity. And like you, the second highest response was greater than 30 years. So that's really interesting. And really what I want to emphasize here is that what we really found out from this is that remedial timeframes relationship to site complexity is somewhat in the eye of the beholder. And the reason for that is state and federal regulations don't typically define what a reasonable timeframe is. But what we do know is we want a timeframe that's based on site objectives that are considerate of technical and non-technical challenges. So now let's talk about how these challenges can increase a remedial timeframe. So the guidance breaks the challenges into two categories, two groups, right? Technical examples and non-technical examples. And of course, under technical, you have things like geologic, hydrogeologic, geochemical, contaminated, related, large scale. Non-technical examples, setting site objectives or changes over long timeframes, regulatory, development and of institutional controls, land use and funding. And this by no means is all inclusive. We want to acknowledge that. There are certainly many other types of challenges, both technical and non-technical, that can occur on any site, and they often do. But we felt that these ones would best exemplify the types of challenges you might encounter on any type of site. So let's dive in and see what those challenges look like a little bit deeper. Starting with geologic conditions under the technical category, these, again, are the challenges and uncertainties that we feel should be part of the initial CSM. And generally speaking, when it comes to CSM, we usually automatically include these technical challenges, though we may not include all of them. So this first category, geologic conditions, you can see here geologic heterogeneity, preferential flow paths, fractured bedrock, karst bedrock, low permeability media. So clearly commonly recognized geologic challenges. Now the image you see on your slide is a photo of heterogeneic, highly stratified sediments. Now imagine this is all occurring below your feet and you have to do assessment of a site, not knowing this. And you put in your monitoring wells to get an idea of groundwater conditions. But if you didn't know what you were looking at, if you didn't know about this karst topography or stratigraphy, occurring below your feet, what you may not realize is that you're actually getting a water table and perhaps a groundwater flow direction that isn't representative of what's really going on. So in your slide now, you'll see that when you put the wells in, you're actually connecting into various zones and which are independent. So this is just an example of how technical complications can rise to increase complexity of a site. So let's talk about next the hydrogeologic conditions, right? There are separate challenges, and of course you have examples there, variable groundwater velocities, fluctuating water tables, deep contamination, surface and groundwater interactions with impacted sediment. The case study, we have multiple case studies that highlight a lot of these things. And then on your slide here, specifically, I'm highlighting the Savannah River site in South Carolina, which had a very complicated conceptual site model, primarily because you had this groundwater plume that was discharging into that 4-mile branch tributary, and it's interacting with these clays and the riparian zone, again, to make it more complicated. There's other case studies like where there's deep contamination, such as at Hanford, where you have contamination down to 250 feet below surface. Also the Velsicol site in Michigan, we have rising groundwater tables which complicate that fate and transport. And there's geochemical conditions. Now, something that we don't always or often encounter, but these challenges are really interesting. You have things like extreme geochemistry, alkalinity, pH, redox conditions, or extreme groundwater temperatures, whether you're located near a geothermal source or in a low temperature area. Often, issues associated, complexities, if you will, around these types of challenges are the sites have limited technical options very often. They typically will be in a more remote area, which requires higher energy use and again, you may have a higher carbon footprint, cost of remediation being more expensive. But the good news is, because of their isolation in general, there's less chance of human exposure. And the picture you see there is the a picture of the North Slope Refinery in Alaska. I'm a California boy, born and raised. So, you know, coming out of my car into that type of environment is not something I would relish, but certainly you could see how being in that environment can make things a lot more complex to deal with. And then we move on to identifying these technical challenges from contaminant-related conditions, right? So we have the light or not, or dense non-aqueous phase liquids, the LNAPLs and DNAPLs. We have recalcitrant contaminants like metals, and high concentrations of multiple contaminants that can occur, or emerging contaminants like PFAS. Highlighting a couple of documents from ITRC on your slide, the Integrated DNAPL Site Strategy document, that guidance was developed in 2011 and is still highly regarded as a key reference document when dealing with DNAPL. And of course, ITRC has helped to lead the way in fact sheets and information on PFAS. That team continues to go forward in producing the most current information on what's happening in the world of PFAS in terms of technology, regulatory changes, and source and history, et cetera. So we'll keep going on and look at some other challenges. Coming back to scale, right? We mentioned the tri-state mining site earlier, and you see it here. And, you know, scale can definitely be a complicating factor. The location and extent of contamination, depth of contamination, the number and type and proximity of receptors, and an extensiveness of commingled plumes, which often can happen as sites grow in size. So imagine, like at the tri-state mining site that you're seeing, here's a site that straddles three states and two EPA regions. So imagine coordinating agency input for decision-making on a site like that. Even things that might be simple at other sites, like underground utility identification, become substantially more complicated in these types of large sites. So now that we've looked at a very large site, let's go the other way. Here's the UGI Columbia Gas Plant Superfund site in Columbia, Pennsylvania. This site is only 1.5 acres in size. It's about 400 feet from the Susquehanna River, but you had 100 years of gas manufacturing, and you had residual tar that got into the sediments and groundwater and deep into fractured bedrock due to overflows from a tar separator. And what we do know, technically speaking, we know that the tar would dissolve over centuries. But what we're trying to explain here and express in this case study is that even small sites can have very difficult technical challenges. So we've given you a glimpse of the types of technical challenges that you might encounter at your site. So now let's turn to the non-technical challenges. Now, I must admit, the non-technical challenges always intrigue me the most. In my opinion, tends to drive sites from a stakeholder perspective. Often, in my experience, perhaps even more so than the technical challenges. You see, the non-technical challenges, they exist at every site, whether or not we formally recognize that or not. And again, when you see it, sites that are more technically challenges, that is more technically challenged, I should say, oftentimes the longer time it will take to achieve the site objectives. And as a result, the non-technical challenges become a bigger factor. Now, examples of commonly encountered non-technical challenges include, again, developing site objectives, changing site objectives, societal expectations, the application of green and sustainable remediation, which we're all trying to achieve much more readily in today's world. Managing changes over long time frames, regulatory, right? Cooperation between federal and state regulatory agencies, changes in laws and regulations. You have orphan sites that may have no funding or be underfunded. And then you have contaminants without regulatory guidance, which we've seen evolving with PFAS, for example. And I think we're going to see with other contaminants of emerging concern, 1,4-dioxane, even microplastics are emerging contaminant of concern far and wide. So there's additional discussion of these types of factors in ITRC's Green and Sustainable Remediation document. And I encourage you to take a look at that document as well. Moving on, we have other technical, non-technical challenges like institutional controls, right? The tracking and managing institutional controls and enforcing has always been difficult. Land use, changing land use over time. The longer a site is in a impacted or remedial state, you know, the higher the probability that there may be a change in land use, multiple owners or site access, all become factors to consider. Funding, you know, a lack of funding or political influence, all these types of things come into play. One realization is that, you know, often in long-term management of a complex Superfund site will go over to the state. And states have their limited amount of funding as well that they have to consider and spread out across their environmental obligations. So again, more examples are discussed in the guidance, and I encourage you to take a look at that. One more example to share with you. This is the VelsiCol site in Michigan. It's a great case study. And as Susan mentioned, we had a really active stakeholder group. And in this case, the stakeholder group actually wrote this case study. It's one of my favorites to read. Background on it is you had 40 years of chemical plant operations that left residual oil, fire retardants, pesticides, and low-level radioactive waste. Ended up impacting the water supplies, livestock, and you had residents' health and economic hardships on businesses, financially distressed responsible parties. The residents formed a community action group and even wrote a book about their struggles. Now, ultimately, the contaminants were removed and renal systems were installed and city water supplies were replaced. But despite, you know, all of the issues and working through these problems, what is clear in this case study is that, you know, the regulators and the community, I think, don't necessarily see eye to eye on definition of success. And that's really an important aspect of thinking about non-technical challenges. Oftentimes on technical, from the technical side, it's what are the regulatory requirements, achieving an MCL or achieving some specific number that will achieve the risk that the regulatory agency will accept. But stakeholders may not see it the same way, right? You have communities, tribes, others that have different views about what success is and what that endpoint should be. And that can really influence the remedial timeframe and the remedial effort. So this is just some examples of non-technical challenges that can extend beyond those technical aspects of a traditional conceptual site model. And because of it, you know, we recommend that considering a paradigm shift where a conceptual site model actually integrates both non-technical challenges as well as technical challenges. And we can look at that from an example here. EPA had done a nice job in their 2011 guidance, which is, this is reflecting of kind of trying to integrate both non-technical and technical. A great other example to look at, the National Environmental Protection Act, and in California, the California Environmental Quality Act. Both of those actually reach out and utilize stakeholder engagement to really consider some of the non-technical impacts and effects that to a remedy or to the endpoint of a site. But we do think that this EPA approach that you're seeing on your screen is a good start for developing a conceptual site model. So definitely something to consider when you're developing your conceptual site model. But the goal is to develop a conceptual site model with sufficient depth and clarity to accurately assess risks and develop appropriate remediation strategies. The conceptual site model should be a dynamic tool that's updated for both technical and non-technical considerations throughout the site's life cycle. And with that, I'd like to summarize what you've heard in for chapter two. First, complex sites typically have multiple challenges, right? And both those technical and non-technical challenges can impede remediation. And by identifying these challenges, you can really improve the conceptual site model and maximize remedial effectiveness. And perhaps more importantly, you can help establish site objectives that can be achieved within a reasonable time frame. You know, one overarching consideration that Susan had mentioned and others will mention following me is that it's encouraged seeking that early stakeholder engagement that help build consensus, especially around remedial timeframe predictions, because doing so can greatly reduce complications that often arise from non-technical challenges. So with that, I'd like to go ahead and introduce my friend, Dr. Charles Newell with GSI Environmental, who's going to discuss the remedial potential assessment. So Chuck, over to you.
Great. Well, thanks, Roy. Today we're going to be talking about this remediation potential assessment. And basically, we got here, but Susan talked about why we're here, what are some of these key problems. And then Roy talked about these challenges we have, both technical and non-technical. But for this part, this remediation potential assessment, what we really want you to learn here is this process to understand, can you get there from here? So really what it's about, of course, this is an ITRC a report, a document, guidance, and so it's got a flow chart in it. I'm going to go into one particular part of the machinery in here, and this remediation potential assessment, where you go through this process to identify whether adaptive site management is warranted due to site challenges. Basically, there are these eight questions, and when you answer them, you come up with this answer that it might be, hey, this supports a high likelihood of achieving remediation objectives in a reasonable timeframe. Or, on the other hand, you may be at a site where, oh, this supports a low likelihood of achieving these objectives in a reasonable timeframe. Then in the process, we combine these eight questions. Now, that's this high-level view. Let's go down to the process and the outcomes, you know, for the particular process we're talking about. So the process, it's really a screening tool that uses this weight of evidence approach to, you know, to assess if site conditions are likely to achieve a remedial objective in a reasonable time frame. And the key part here is that it's based on these eight questions. And just to maybe give a little bit of perspective on how this works, I was at a wedding reception a long time ago with this person who was sitting next to me, and he was a recruiter for Shell, hired a number of people every week. And he sort of would, you know, somewhat of an exaggeration, he says, well, whenever I interview one of these 10 or 20 people every week that I talk to, I ask them these two questions. And he said, with these questions, I can see into a person's soul and really understand if they're going to be a good employee or not. I'd done recruiting, so I was interested in this, but this really relates to this remediation potential assessment, because the ITRC group, the complex site groups, we worked for about 2 years to come up with these eight questions that when answered, you can see into the soul of your site in some ways and see how all this works. Okay, so that's a little bit about the process. It's this weight of evidence approach that's used to assess if sites likely to achieve these objectives in a reasonable timeframe. Now, it's also this process, it's a basis for aligning expectations with actual remediation potential. And for example, you might have somebody on the stakeholders would say, you know, we can't clean this site up. We should just walk away, basically. Can't do anything about it. On the other hand, there might be a stakeholder that says, we could keep working on this site till we get every last molecule to contaminate out. So this is a process that tries to align the expectations of what we can and can't do at sites. And finally, the process, it's trying to promote this, effective and transparent interaction between people. And the key thing, the outcome, it's not, is your site complex or not, but is this, is your site one that using this adaptive site management approach that we're going to talk about later in the talk, is that really this key thing that's going to help you get through this whole process? Now, one note that even at sites that are relatively simple, there are advantages of still using this adaptive site management approach. But in the flow chart, this is the key question. You go through this, and if you've got one of these sites where it's the low likelihood of getting to these remedial objectives in a short time frame, a reasonable time frame, adaptive site management, that's the ticket for you. Okay, so let's go on and we're going to now talk about, can you get there from here? Just two real quick slides to try to set the stage about how these questions sort of work. And when I went through this, it was sort of this really strange combination of artificial intelligence in my family coming up with this particular slide here. And the artificial intelligence part is part of my PhD work a long time ago. We were doing expert systems where you would ask a series of if-then questions and put it into these special programs to try to elucidate or to try to harvest this knowledge from experts. But then, so then when my brother-in-law came to me one time, said he inherited this property in Tennessee, and that's not the property, but it was a convenience store, had some gasoline down there. He was worried, is this going to cost him a lot of money? Is it going to be a problem? So then I start going into expert mode, and we're all experts on the call here, but we have these questions. Hey, how big's this site? Is there any apple? I start asking these questions, and I quickly come up with, hey, this is a small, shallow site. It's got a sandy water bearing unit. They're in low concentrations. It's benzene. That attenuates pretty fast. There's not much in apple. I say, this is not going to be a big problem. And Uncle Brian, as I call him, he's happy and sends me a nice gift and all this stuff. So that's, can you get there from here? The one example. Now, another example, however, if somebody comes to you and says that their investment group, well, they purchased this site right in here. And you look at this and you see this large, deep contamination, much of it's the source is under buildings or things that are difficult to get around. It's sand, silt, fractured clays. There's not much biodegradation. The concentrations are really high. You need a 99% reduction. Those going through this list of questions that you asked, you start saying, this is going to be a very difficult site. And you make note to yourself, don't loan this person any money. It's going to be a tough thing for them to try to develop. So that's a little bit about the perspective on how these eight questions work in a very simple basis. Okay, so let's go to the purpose of this remedial potential assessment, intended to inform the remedial decision process and determine if adaptive management processes are beneficial. It's designed to be to facilitate this transparency and future reviews of how this logic was put together with this structured process. And it's flexible, though, that you can modify it, for your site. So you can, it's not this rigid thing. You have to do all these steps. So that's sort of the purpose of it. Now, here's some do's and do not out there. It does allow this flexibility and site-specific inputs required that you do. And you can go through this iterative process as you sort of build your conceptual model about do I need to do this adaptive site management? Can I reach these remediation objectives? It does require a lot of supporting data. You have to know your site. It's not like the site where you have this one monitoring well out there or it's more regional information. No, you've got to start collecting information so you can process these particular questions. And it does consider remediation in the context of other pertinent factors. So it's putting all these things together. So that's the key things that it does. Now, what doesn't it do? Well, it doesn't provide a means to avoid requirements. Now, this is just trying to understand how you're going to manage the site from the future. And if it's one of these complex sites, then this adaptive site management approach may be the best, or likely to be the best way to try to get through this. It doesn't tell you this answer whether a site's complex or not. Now, this is this gateway to trying to understand, should I use this adaptive site management? The process does not directly consider cost. Now, some of the questions implicitly have cost in there, as you'll see, but that sort of doesn't directly do this. And finally, it doesn't produce a default decision, that's out there. So let's go ahead and start. We're going to sort of go through some of these and talk about the questions. I think we're getting close to sort of going through some of them. And just a quick note is that in some ways, this is like this autobiography of Steve Jobs. It's the journey is the reward. We're trying to go through this. People are going to work with these questions. And in this case, well, there's eight of them. So I'm going to go to the first one and try to frame how they're used. And the first question is, well, how difficult is it to work at the surface of your site? I've got sort of a yin and a yang, a one case or another case. Somebody calls back and says, hey, we're out there at the site. It's literally a cow pasture. We can drive our direct push rigs out here to do this more characterization or inject stuff. Hey, this one's pretty easy. And you'd say to yourself, okay, that data set, when I'm answering this question, that's a higher likelihood then I can achieve my site objectives just because I can get out there and I can interact with the subsurface. On the other hand, if it's something like this, you know, it's a subdivision. It's really hard to work out here, or it's under a runway. And you'd say, oh, this is going to be very difficult because the access simply is not there. It's underneath a huge shopping mall. That'd be difficult. So you'd say that's a low likelihood of achieving these remedial objectives in a reasonable time frame. So that's question number one. Well, let's keep going. We're on a roll. So question number two, how difficult is it to drill at a site? So this is going in more into the subsurface, and the crew calls back, you know, it's all pretty shallow. We can even hand auger this stuff. Hey, this is going to be this high likelihood. We're going to give that a high. On the other hand, this stuff is this basalt, and it's really deep. We got to go down 400 feet, and I got to use air rotary, and then it's going to be just incredible pain. It's going to be expensive. That's hard to engage in the subsurface when it's that expensive to get down there. We're going to call this a low likelihood. Okay, let's keep going. What's the scale or source of the plume or the source zone? And so this is really about different sizes in there. If somebody comes in, hey, it's the size of the big conference room in our office, then you start saying, oh, that's a high likelihood. You know, if nothing else, we can just excavate this stuff if it's shallow. But then you start getting bigger, and then things get more exponential, and it gets larger and larger. And if it's something that, you know, this is 500,000 cubic yards of a source zone, that's one of the biggest remediation projects that's out there. If you were going to try to remove those contaminants. So green dot, you're going to give that a high. Red dot, you're just going to say, for this category, this question, I got to give it a low. Okay, so we're going to keep going through the eight. What contaminant reduction is needed? For this is one of my key themes, is that I think probably everybody here sort of knows this intuitively, but our business, this remediation business, this is an order of magnitude world or universe that we live in. It's all about ooms and reductions. And just think about a slug test. We talk about, oh, it's a 10 to the minus 5 centimeter per second silt, or it's a 10 to the minus 2 centimeter per second sand. That's orders of magnitude difference. Think about plume maps. You know, look at those contours. Here's 10 ppb, here's 100, here's 1,000. That's order of magnitude. So then if you're thinking about, this question is about how far do you have to go? What is your source concentration now? What is your remediation goal? And how many orders of magnitude do you have to go? And if it's 90%, hey, that's doable. If you look at some of these databases of remediation performance, a lot of them can do it. 99%, that gets a lot tougher. That's less than half of remediation projects and chlorinated solvent sites can get there. 3 nines, that's tough. And getting red in here, if you got 4 nines, it's even tougher. So this sort of fits in there and sort of regulate, it sort of talks about the source concentration versus that remediation goal. So for PFAS, all of a sudden, you're talking about a much lower, a preliminary remediation goal, 70 nanograms per liter right now for PFOA plus PFOS. So that's how that gets built in question four. Number five, do site constituents readily attenuate relative to the travel time to any receptor? So this is about travel time and what happens as those dissolved contaminants are migrating down gradient from the source zone. And let's say it's this organic chemistry quiz. What do you think this is? This is my favorite groundwater contaminant of all time. This is toluene, and this is the guy that just goes away like sugar, you know, almost. It just goes away very fast. At this Bemidji research site, the USGS looked at LNAPL site, after about 35 years, all the toluene was gone from this crude oil spill. But on the other hand, if you got like these PCBs down here, and potentially at some sites, if you have some, say, PFOS or PFOA, those things don't degrade readily, right? So toluene, you give it a high. If it's one of these like PCBs below, maybe that's a low in terms of trying to answer question five. Okay, just number six, does difficult to remove mass exist at the site? And, you know, my background's, I'm a chemical engineer. And so when this remediation field sort of blossomed in the 90s and the 2000s, the idea is, hey, geology is not important. It's a sandbox down there. We're just going to inject these chemicals. It's all about the chemical process and doing this stuff. So we we did this and we did make a lot of sites better, but there were this wall that seemed we got to, this constraint where we couldn't get much farther, and not a lot of sites got completely cleaned up to MCLs. And the reason is, I call it the revenge of the geologists. It's a lot of this heterogeneity. It's like these low permeability zones. This is this really famous Matrix diffusion movie. It's about 3 minutes of this tank where you can see this, you can visualize matrix diffusion. Feel free to send me an email. I can send you this video. It's pretty neat. It's also in the environmental wiki video under matrix diffusion and the Enviro wiki from ESTCP. But if you're up, if you do have something, it's more like a sandbox, you're going to call that a high. But if you do have unconsolidated system, or you have this fractured rock where matrix diffusion is important, I'm going to give that a low. So here's just this, before I do the last two, just this Paducah site, and this is in the complex site guidance. We're talking about these different figures, but let's just say surface access, you know, maybe we call that a low because there's this big building in there, okay? Drilling difficulty, we're going down to 90 feet, but I see gravel in here. That's going to be hard for direct push, so maybe that's a medium or that's a low. The scale of that source or plume, the plume was actually pretty long, over 1,000 feet, so maybe you'd call that a low. And so, but this is just, I'm sort of talking about this just very quickly, but the entire stakeholders work together and talk about each ones. And is it really high? Is it really low? Is it medium? You know, what do we call these? Okay, concentration reduction. I think at this site, this was more than two orders of magnitude. So maybe that would turn into a low. Attenuation, there was some biodegradation of the TCE. We see some daughter products in there, so maybe that's a medium. Difficult to remove mass. Yeah, look at that stratigraphy. You know, that's not a sandbox down there. So maybe that's a low. So you put all those together, just trying to get to this field. We'll go through some cases in here in just a minute. Last two questions. What's the predicted performance for available remediation technologies? And so there are a series of documents here that say, this is when we compile a bunch of these sites together, these remediation projects, this is primarily for chlorinated solvents. You can sort of get a sense of, well, you know, the median percent reduction is about one order of magnitude, about one ohm or 90%. So you could sort of, for your site, for your geology, you know, for your chemicals, you can do this analysis and try to answer seven as high, medium, or low. And then what's your predicted remediation time frame is the last question. And you can do something like this, where you have a different model that a very simple one would say, if it's just the contaminants that are in the fractures, they go away pretty quick in 50 years. But as you get more and more complex, then it's longer and longer as you deal with matrix diffusion and can extend those remediation timeframes. And we have a list of models in here. This REMCLOR MD model is a real key one because it can handle matrix diffusion. Okay, just a couple of slides left. We're going to go in, and the way that this works is you can have these eight categories. You're going to put a check, high, medium, or low for each one. And if you want, you can accumulate the numbers below. And in the end says, hey, for this particular one, the weight of evidence, there's four check marks under high. Hey, we've got a shot of making these objectives in a reasonable time frame. You can weight these different if you want. You know, it can be you put in different ones, take ones out, pretty flexible process. But on the other hand, if you have something like this, the access is moderate, drilling, oh, it's pretty easy, but it's a medium-sized site. Oh, I got a long way to go in terms of those concentrations. I got to go 3 nines. The attenuation is moderate. There's a ton of matrix diffusion out there. It's just got a lot of heterogeneity. It's an unconsolidated system. You know, it's fluvial, whatever. Technology performance says, it's tough to get to 3 nines. The time frame model says it's a long time. Then you would look at these and you would say, this one has a low likelihood of achieving the renewal objectives. When I sum all eight of them up, hey, I got to do that adaptive site management. Okay. Now, this was primarily in this section is talking about, hey, sort of a priori starting out, what do you do? But there's also stuff that the remedy is ongoing. You can go in there into those feedback loops and just say, hey, do I need to try something else or whatever? And so in these questions are, has the existing remedy been really operated efficiently and has it been maintained well? The next question is that, you know, are the aquifer conditions, contaminant sources characterized? Has anything changed? So we're trying to, this part of the document or this remedial petition assessment, when we're sort of taking this new view and looking at this existing system, maybe it's a pump and treat system that's been out there for 10 years, you start, the stakeholders start asking these questions. Are concentration reductions occurring at the rate they anticipated? Are you following this glide path that people thought about in the very beginning? Does this remedy address contaminants and hydrogeologic conditions? And can interim or another site objectives be met with other technologies within a reasonable time frame? Okay, so summing up, this is a screening tool. It really provides this valuable process. It doesn't produce a default decision. You answer these 8 technical questions and use this weight of evidence approach to assess if the site is likely to achieve your remediation objectives. It allows flexibility and site-specific input, you know, in this iterative process that stakeholders would go through to sort of work the problem at their site. And the goal is to determine if site objectives are likely attainable or, hey, this remediation potential is low, adaptive site management will be important. So I think at this point, I think that's it for me. And I think we're going to go next to the question and answer break. So take it away. Mm-hmm.
At this time, we are going to pause to see if we have any questions out there that we can have our expert panelists answer for you during this. So for those of you that are new to Zoom, there is a Q&A window down at the bottom of your screen that you can scroll over, have that pop up and type into it. We do have a question, and Chuck, I'm going to point this your direction to start with, just because it follows along with the slides that you were just giving. So for the PRA evaluation criteria, is there guidance on how to select high, moderate, or low? Is it somewhat subjective, or is it defined by a time frame?
That's a great question, and it depends on which ones. For the size question, we do provide some of these guidances on what a typical remediation project is. And I think there's a number in there that the middle 50% of in-situ remediation projects for chlorinated solvent sites was between, 2,000 and 25,000 cubic yards. And so you can use that as this basis. There's some information about the remediation performance, again, largely geared to chlorinated solvents, but there's also some of these floating around for fuels as well. For time frame, no, we don't have those numbers. We don't prescribe those right now. So, but great question. Mm-hmm.
Great, thanks, John. Susan, I'm going to target you for this next question, if you don't mind, because I always think that these questions about stakeholders are interesting, and I know that you responded privately, but let's share with everybody what are options if stakeholders, such as adjacent or current landowners, resist using risk-based management from the outset?
That's a good question. It really does speak to how important it is to have, be able to have a well-functioning team and have good stakeholder integration. I think that it probably goes without saying in large complex sites like this, sort of no entity is really an island, really. So it can be very difficult to move forward if there isn't buy-in from all stakeholders. And so I guess I would kind of direct you to chapter 7 of the guidance, maybe to look at perspectives for stakeholder involvement. But I guess I would just really answer that by observing that it is very difficult to move forward if there isn't, in fact, stakeholder buy-in from all involved parties, particularly as involves adjacent landowners.
Yeah, thank you, Susan, for that. All right, we'll just pause for just a second here to see if any other questions come in. We do have a Q&A break at the end of the session as well, so we always encourage you to use the Q&A pod throughout the presentation. You don't have to hold your questions until the end. And I'll take a moment that with the new platform here, you will have an opportunity to complete the feedback form for those of you that are interested in receiving the certificate of completion. We will share all of that at the end of the session still. And so with that, I am going to move us along here, and I will introduce Elizabeth Hawley and give her control of the screen to move us into adaptive remedies. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Thanks, Nicole. A second here, I'll get my video on. Maybe I took control first. That's fine. I'll just move forward like this. So I'm going to be presenting the next section of the training today, and it's on adaptive remedy selection. So at this point in the process, we might have already completed the remediation potential assessment that Chuck just described, and then determined that our site has low remediation potential and might therefore benefit from adaptive site management. So the first stage in that process then is adaptive remedy selection. Content that I'm presenting is summarized in chapter 4 of our guidance document. And the main learning objective for this section of the training is really understanding and applying adaptive site management principles during remedy selection. So we can take a closer look at the adaptive site management process as shown on the flow chart. Let's just make this a little bit bigger. This is the same flow chart, figure 1 in our guidance that others in this training have already described portions of. And the steps that are shown here in light blue, these three steps are really the adaptive remedy selection process. So those would be refining the conceptual site model, setting or revisiting site objectives, and developing interim objectives and the adaptive remedial strategy. There are sometimes, as you see on the flowchart, you might be going through this for the first time at your site, or you might be going through this process because of the need to reevaluate a remedy that isn't working to meet performance objectives. And with complex sites, I think particularly those that where we began decades ago and have learned a significant amount since that time, it's not unusual that at complex sites that there is a need to revisit a remedy. I do have a poll question for you. I know a lot of people in the audience are working on complex sites. So the poll question is basically, at that site, have you needed to revisit a remedy? And if so, what actions were taken? And you'll note that, in our flowchart, before getting to this point, there would be, remedy optimization, which would involve, for example, remedy modifications or improvements, also implementing a contingency remedy if one was specified. So I'll give people a minute to complete that poll, and then we can show the results. And this is consistent with what we've seen at other training courses, that this is not an uncommon experience. So you're often going through this, revisiting a previous remedy. Either yes, this has happened, or maybe there's a need to do this. The takeaway here is really, if there is a need to reevaluate the remedy, we see this process as really similar. You're still going back and repeating each of these three steps. So I'll walk through each of those now. So the first would be the refining the conceptual site model. And the conceptual site model would need to be updated to describe the site challenges and the key uncertainties that Roy went through on the chapter 2 of the guidance document. What we're talking about here is, if there was a remedy that was implemented and it failed to meet performance expectations, we probably learned something that can be used to improve the conceptual site model. We need to understand and communicate what is inhibiting remedial progress, what previous assumptions that we had before have now changed, what data gaps remain. And it's really consistent with all the previous guidance in our industry around emphasizing the conceptual site model as a dynamic tool and the need to update that before making key decisions. Appendix B in the guidance document provides a number of different tools for remedy evaluation. You might want to take a look at that if you're at this stage of remedy reevaluation at your site, as well as some other ITRC references. We reference the integrated site characterization approach that was described by a previous ITRC team in 2015. It could also be useful in updating the conceptual site model. So here is an example of one tool that was used to improve the conceptual site model. It's the 14 compartment model, and it was used at one of the detailed case study sites that are included in the document, as Susan described, the industrial site in Australia. And at this site, there is chlorinated hydrocarbons that were released into the environment after a grass fire in a drum storage area. So the resulting plume extends into the underlying fractured basalt aquifer. It also followed underground sewer lines. And site managers use this 14 compartment model to basically estimate the magnitude of contamination that they had in various media. So soil vapor, DNAPL, or dense non-aqueous phase liquid in groundwater or sorbed into soils in both transmissive as well as low permeability zones. And they considered the source area, the plume area, and in this case, also the off-site plume area. And by going through this exercise, it really provided stakeholders with a more holistic view of the problem. And it, I think, promoted awareness of which aspects of contamination could be addressed by remedial technologies and what some of the limitations might be in that process. So after updating the conceptual site model, we need to set or revisit site objectives. And the site objectives are the overall remedial goals, which would be based on the regulatory expectations and requirements. And then when setting objectives, you know, you might have different objectives for different units of the site, maybe different hydrogeologic units or different operable units, which we call site segments in our document. We basically want to be in agreement among stakeholders that the site objectives are achievable within a reasonable time frame. And then if progress is not sufficient, despite optimization of the technology, we might need to revisit the site objectives with the purpose of assessing whether those are achievable within a reasonable time frame. So what are typical site objectives? At CERCLA sites, which would be sites in the US Superfund program, all final remedies must be protective of human health and the environment and must comply with ARARs, which are applicable or relevant and appropriate requirements, or meet very specific criteria for an ARAR waiver. And I've just clicked ahead here and list out what each of those criteria are. There's more information on each of these in the guidance document. I'll just speak to a few today. So interim measures, these do not need to meet ARARs, but they're basically temporary because sites eventually need to select a final remedy. Greater risk refers to the determination that compliance with an ARAR would result in greater risk to human health and the environment than not complying. And we've seen this argument used at sediment sites where there's perhaps a sensitive ecosystem and a wetland environment, and given the amount of sedimentation that's occurred, that there would be more harm to the ecosystem in dredging that versus just sort of managing it in place, for example. Another would be technical impracticability, or TI waivers. These have been used, I think, at a few CERCLA sites as of 2017 for the entire population of Superfund sites over time. They've been used over, you know, over 100 times or around 100 times. So in general, these ARAR waivers are not commonly used. I do have a poll question for you. I don't know if any of you have evaluated or considered ARAR waivers at your site. Be interested to know if any of you have been through this process and ultimately what approach was selected if it was considered. And I suspect that because we see it rarely documented as being chosen as the approach, that maybe we don't have a lot of experience within our audience. But. So a few of you have considered but did not formally evaluate, but the majority know have not been through that process before. There's definitely a lot of interest in the process in the team that we were a part of. And so we did include, you know, some case studies that had implemented technical and practicability waivers. We also go into a little bit more detail of what that process looks like and in the guidance document. So I'll walk through one case study here. This is the Copper's Oroville Wood Treatment Facility in Northern California. And this remedy goes back to 1999 when the remedy was amended to include a TI waiver for a 4-acre area on site. The site basically was contaminated with creosote, dense non-aqueous phase liquid, pentachlorophenol, and dioxins and furans. So it's, you know, typical contaminants for a wood treatment facility. And by including a technical impracticability waiver in the record of decision, they essentially changed the goal within that 4-acre area from complete restoration to containment. And they reached that decision after a pretty significant effort to identify a technology that they thought could meet cleanup goals at the time. They did a number of different treatability studies of bio, soil washing, chemical fixation. And ultimately, the TI zone was just one component of the overall remedy, which also included excavation, on-site landfill, and industrial use deed restriction, in addition to the TI waiver. CERCLA regulations, so still at CERCLA sites and thinking about alternatives or revisiting site objectives. CERCLA regulations also authorize the use of alternate concentration limits, otherwise known as ACLs, under very specific conditions. So this is for sites where groundwater is discharging to surface water. There's not a statistically significant increase in contaminant concentrations downstream of that discharge point. And there is no point of exposure to the offsite contaminated groundwater prior to discharge. And if those conditions are met, it essentially allows the use of an alternate concentration that takes into account the concentration in surface water. But we note in our guidance that there really have not been any CERCLA sites that have used ACLs since 2005, to our knowledge. So again, this is not something that we're recommending as a team. We're just providing information about it in the guidance document due to the number of questions and interest from the team. So when we get to state cleanup programs, including the Resource Conservation Recovery Act or RCRA programs, it's a lot harder to find comprehensive information on what acceptable approaches there are for setting or revisiting site objectives. And that's really because the RCRA program is typically administered by the states and there's not one single database. But the ITRC team was in a great position to ask states directly because of the number of state agency and involvement or the amount on our team. So early on in the team building process, we surveyed the state points of contact and we asked them several different questions. So we asked, does your state or tribal program allow the following to meet site objectives? And we listed about 25 different approaches, such as institutional controls, designating alternate points of compliance, TI waivers, just basically everything. And we also asked states if they used those or if they had the ability to use those as a primary means when building a remedy, and also if the original remedy had failed to meet site objectives and they were going back and adjusting site objectives after the remedy had failed to meet the performance expectations. And here are some of the results. So the bar graphs basically show the number of states that indicated that they did use each of the approaches. So we learned it's common for states to use risk-based site-specific criteria, institutional controls, designated points of compliance. And in contrast, only about half of the state programs who responded indicated that they were able to use or had used alternate concentration limits, TI waivers, plume management zones, low threat closure criteria. Again, if you're interested in any of these, the guidance does describe some of the state cleanup program language and provide some examples of them for your reference. So that's kind of a summary of our guidance content on the process of setting and revisiting site objectives. So the third step in this overall process is developing interim objectives and the adaptive remedial strategy. And the interim objectives are basically designed to be steps or milestones for achieving the overall site objectives. They might be specific to one technology or to one area of the site. And we understood that achieving an interim objective would lead you into the next phase of remediation. Because this is a key concept, I do have another poll question to just kind of get your feedback on this, and we can spend more time discussing it if needed. So the poll question is basically asking you to differentiate between site objective or interim objective. So restore groundwater to beneficial use or reduce mass flux offsite by 50% within 5 years so that hydraulic control is no longer needed. And while you're already done. Okay. So I think that people basically get it from the results of this poll. So I don't think we need to discuss this concept in too much more detail then. This next slide, I'll just move through pretty quickly. Basically, set interim objectives, not just the long-term site objectives. And that makes it easier to basically assess remedy performance over the shorter term and set up performance-based criteria for evaluating how well a remedy is progressing, if it's progressing as expected. Eventually, you would want these interim objectives to be SMART, that is specific, measurable, obtainable, relevant, and time-bound. And we present some examples in our guidance document. So basically, the next step then, and you'd kind of be doing this in parallel, because it's hard to finalize an interim objective that's perhaps technology related and helping you determine what you've achieved with that technology without also knowing what technologies you're working with. So the process of building the adaptive remedial strategy would proceed in parallel with that. You start by identifying the technologies and other approaches that could be potential components of a coordinated remedy for the site. So you're asking, what are the tools in our toolbox here? What do we have to work with? And this just shows an excerpt, very small excerpt from a table in the guidance that provides a description of each of the remedial technologies that are commonly used and provides some references. If you're looking into this and in want references, look to in more detail. So the next step would be assembling and comparing the remedial approaches. You'd be following your given regulatory process for this. So the 9 criteria, if you're working at a Superfund site, kind of basically following a feasibility study process. And then at RCRA sites, we'd be using a similar threshold criteria and balancing criteria. When we were talking about this stage in the process as a team, we did compile a list of additional considerations for consideration at complex sites. And I'll just list these out here for you to take into account if you're at this stage at your site. Level of confidence and ability to implement the remedy was one that the team discussed. Synergy with other technologies and approaches, adaptability over time, information gained to improve future decisions. This was key. The idea that there would be value in advancing the site toward its objectives and managing contamination, even if it wasn't fully successful, if we're able to interrogate the system and improve our conceptual site model, there would be a value in that. Robustness of design, we've talked about interim objectives, and there's also more discussion in the guidance about metrics and performance monitoring. And then other considerations, for example, whether one approach is more green or sustainable compared to another. So either during recognizing that we're working with perhaps multiple technologies and objectives, and those might be implemented in different areas of the site or over time, we did envision preparing a matrix of the site objectives and the remedy components for each area of the site and just seeing how the technologies align with the site objectives. And then once you've gotten to the remedy selection stage for the selected remedy, you could have another component here that adds in the interim objectives as well. So that might be something like source removal, containment, exposure control, perhaps returning some portions of the site to beneficial reuse. We didn't have a case study that had gone through this process, but we took a look at one of the case studies in the guidance document and basically mapped out how their approach might look. So one of the case studies in our document is Rocky Mountain Arsenal in Colorado. It's a former chemical weapons manufacturing facility that supported World War II and then continued operations in the 1950s. And it's currently one of the largest urban wildlife refuges in the United States. It's over 12,000 acres or 50 square kilometers. And this site basically has land use restrictions in place in perpetuity that restrict residential development and use of the site. It restricts agricultural use, human consumption of fish and game, and it limits access to capped and covered areas. So while the on-site area has been capped following extensive excavation of the top 10 feet, there's also boundary pump and treat systems operating. And so if we line up the interim and final remedy components and see how those map to site objectives for Rocky Mountain Arsenal, this is basically what you would come up with. And you can see some common technologies that are in use for containment and source treatment and removal, and also some more unique elements that you might not have considered and may or may not be applicable at your site, such as a medical monitoring program, a trust fund that was set up to ensure that there were sufficient funds for long-term operation and maintenance, and then potable water supply and distribution. So in thinking about how to document the final remedy, you could use a table like the one that we just discussed or that I just described. Basically, we're recommending that you follow regulatory guidelines in terms of how and when to document the remedial approach and give some thought to describing when and how to transition from one technology to the next. If your site includes a remedial strategy that basically incorporates multiple technologies. And we talk a little bit about technology transitions in chapter 5 of the guidance document. And as Susan and others have mentioned previously in this training, throughout this whole process of remedy selection, there's opportunities to involve stakeholders and tribes. And our team, we were fortunate to have multiple stakeholders who were part of our team that had direct experience representing communities who've been impacted by environmental contamination. They shared their knowledge and some examples of how the community engagement benefited the site remedy overall. Also, their tips for interested stakeholders and tribal representatives to get more engaged in the remedy selection process, you know, like how to access information and create forums and ways that the community influenced key decisions at complex sites in the past, advice about advisory boards and technical assistance grants. And then from the stakeholder, from the perspective of responsible parties, the document also included some tips for increasing stakeholder and tribal engagement. And those are summarized in chapter 7 of our guidance document. And here I think are just maybe, these are the same common themes that we see throughout the environmental industry. But as Susan mentioned, at complex sites, there's often, there's the stakeholder agreement and collaboration, and that process can be a challenge in itself and is really crucial to being able to move forward in a remedy. I think Roy mentioned a site that had, I think it was a multi-state site. And so it's also important to note that at complex sites, the stakeholder group can be larger and more complex as well. So just to summarize, we've talked about a number of different key principles of adaptive site management. It's important to refine the conceptual site model and revisit site objectives to determine if they're achievable within a reasonable timeframe. We learned about several different approaches within the RCRA and CERCLA and other state programs for setting the achievable site objectives. We also talked about building an adaptive remedial strategy and recognize that at complex sites, we may need multiple technologies or phases of treatment for each site area over time. And the importance of setting interim objectives and performance metrics to guide the remedial progress over the short term. So the final section of our training is long-term management. So long-term operation, management, performance monitoring. And I'm going to turn it over now to Sam Brock, formerly Air Force Civil Engineer Center. Sam.
Thank you, Elizabeth. I appreciate that review of how to select and design your remedies. And long-term management is the process of implementing the remedial approach that we've selected based on our assessment of remediation potential, the analysis of site conditions, and the detailed analysis of approaches that are described in Chapter 4. And the purpose of long-term management is to verify that we've installed our remediation properly and that it is working as expected. Now, the first step in that process is to develop a long-term management plan, which is a written performance-based plan for adaptive site management. And this plan describes the activities and the evaluations necessary to make timely decisions about the remediation's progress over extended time intervals. And if we look at the flow diagram, the dark blue section relates to the information in Chapter 5. And the key steps shown in this portion of the roadmap are planning, which we're talking about, the site-specific remedial design and implementation. This is the detailed design that's described in using the tools in Chapter 4. And then systematic monitoring and evaluation of the monitoring data to assess where the remediation progress is going as expected. Performance evaluations must be scheduled to allow timely actions and when necessary to achieve acceptable remediation performance. These changes or management decisions in progress are the adaption part of adaptive site management. We'll talk more about how these steps or the decision logic work with performance evaluations. The purpose of the plan is to provide a framework establishing allowing the management team to learn as we go. The plan should include actions to identify weak links in the remedial approach, to inform decision makers about remedial progress, and it's a basis to communicate with stakeholders. The plan also is where we document the overall site completion strategy. This will often extend over decades, and it documents remedy expectations, including how progress will be evaluated. It expedites remedy evaluations using the decision logic shown in the flowchart and triggers timely transitions to alternate remedial approaches when necessary. These scheduled evaluations facilitate timely remedial management decisions during the site's life cycle. Components of the plan include a description of the overall site completion strategy to be deployed over time and space, a description of the selected remedy for the current phase of remediation. This refers to combined remedies or incremental remedies deployed over time. It includes a description of expected remedial performance over time as shown as projected dates to reach interim goals. Predictions must be based on a quantitative performance model. The plan describes timing and criteria for site monitoring and accomplishing periodic evaluations, and describes when and how decision logic for remedy transitions will be applied, including quantitative performance metrics. It also addresses how remediation project risk will be mitigated. We'll briefly comment on these components in the long-term management plan. The site completion strategy is a long-term playbook that describes the path to achieve overall site objectives. For complex sites, this site will likely be iterative and based on a collaborative process. The strategy should consider options to maximize future land use and may employ different approaches in various site segments based on land use. Be sure to consult relevant regulatory and technical guidance when developing your site completion strategy. The cited references shown on slide 82 provide further information on exit strategies and planning remedy completion. Remedial projects, particularly at complex sites, often encounter barriers to satisfactory remedial technology performance. The ITRC guidance, Project Risk Management for Site Remediation, provides approaches and tools to help identify and assess significant project risk and provides information on actions to reduce risk as well as information on how to develop contingency plans to mitigate potential impacts. The team recommends referring to the RRM guidance to help develop contingency responses for unexpected events and stalled remedial progress. In the description of the selected remedy, describe planned actions for each segment of the site and how much each action is expected to contribute to the overall site objectives. For example, what approaches will be deployed to control dissolved phase contamination? How will source areas be mitigated? And will off-site contamination require specific action? For complex sites, interim objectives are critical to timely assessment of a remedial effectiveness. Clearly state interim objectives and the expected time frame to reach the objective for each remedial component. Also list performance metrics that will be used to track progress. Note that specific numerical objectives and projected timeframes may need to be set and or modified during long-term management when more adequate site-specific data are available. Also describe key remedial system maintenance and monitoring requirements to assess remediation technology performance, as well as how to track contaminant movement and changes in contaminant levels. The example table on slide 85 shows an approach to present each site objective, the remedy components to address each objective, and the respective interim objectives and quantifiable performance metrics are listed in an example table. The team recommends using tables, graphics, and flowcharts to the extent practicable for clear communication. The summary addresses contaminant remediation, migration control, and preventing exposure. You will need to modify the entries in your table to match your site strategy and technical approach. If you refer to Table 12 in the guidance document, there's more information and an expanded list there. Slide 86 is an example of a performance model. Performance models are a graphic projection of the expected change in site contamination over time resulting from remedial action. Each projection should be based on a quantifiable performance metric. Projected contaminant concentrations will be compared to actual concentrations and is the key to assessing progress during performance evaluations. ITRC has prepared guidance on projecting remediation performance. Chuck Newell talked about this. It's expanded in the Appendix B to the guidance. And there's a number of tools to help you develop these models. These tools are listed in the guidance document, and we refer you to the RCMS one to get a more comprehensive list. The long-term management plan must describe a schedule for monitoring site conditions and technology performance, as well as specify when periodic remediation performance evaluations will be accomplished. You need to align your monitoring to assess whether remediation performance is adequate to achieve interim or overall site objectives by the projected date. You need to tailor your monitoring frequency and locations to site conditions based on rates of groundwater and contaminant movement and the expected rate of contaminant attenuation. During each performance evaluation, monitoring data are compared to the expected performance model, and the steps in the decision logic determine whether progress is satisfactory or if adaptive site management is warranted. To illustrate this approach, slide 88 will present an example of site performance evaluation. This hypothetical example assumes a volatile contaminant in unsaturated soil being remediated using soil vapor extraction. The margin of the green area is the performance model graph from slide 86. The yellow band is one standard deviation below the predicted rate of contaminant change, representing variable performance. And the red area shows unacceptable performance. The black dashed line from time zero shows actual contaminant concentrations based on 18 months monitoring data, which are compared to predicted change. At 1.5 years, we note reduced performance that triggered optimization of the remedial system. The green dashed line represents site conditions following optimization of the remedial system and shows improved performance. However, asymptotic levels after 2.5 years represents the maximum benefit of the SVE approach. At 3 years, continuing monitored indicates unacceptable performance, and applying the decision logic, the remedial approach transitioned to natural attenuation of residual contamination and decommissioning of the MNA system or the SVE system at that time. We have a poll at this point that asks, when is the best time to review technology performance in detail? And we'll give you a second to take a look at that, and then we'll come back to the results with Nicole's help in a few minutes. Slide 85 shows part of a periodic evaluation checklist contained in the guidance. Use the checklist to help guide troubleshooting underperforming remedial systems. Note that the performance model and decision logic identify unacceptable performance, but not why remediation underperforms. A systematic review of the site, including CMS, contaminant characteristics, site characterization, and plume dynamics should be part of every performance evaluation. More comprehensive evaluations should be done as needed. And as we look at the results of the poll, we see the majority say every periodic evaluation. And then secondly, after every monitoring event. Every monitoring event may or may not warrant an in-depth review, but we certainly want to look at the results of our review at each occurrence. An expanded checklist is found at Table 13 in the guidance document. And again, you should modify your checklist based on your site conditions and the particular strategy that you're implementing. When applying the decision logic, comparing predicted to actual rates of change during the performance evaluations, you're going to arrive at one of four possible conclusions. If we go down the left-hand portion of the flowchart, we can see that the first option is remediation is complete. This is not likely at complex sites, but is included for completeness. As we transition to the right-hand portion of the flowchart, we can see that we can arrive at a conclusion that remediation is on schedule, that optimization is warranted, or that a revised approach is needed. And this may include implementing a contingency remedy or repeating site evaluation approaches described in section 4. And we went through these examples really when we reviewed the hypothetical system on slide 88, where we noted initial satisfactory progress. We came to a point requiring optimization, and we concluded with a transition to an alternative approach. Looking at an actual remediation site in Colorado, remediation addressed two recalcitrant chemicals, TCE and NDMA, and fractured rock 125 feet below surface. The interim actions demonstrated enhanced in situ bioremediation was partially successful for TCE, but the bioremediation reached asymptotic levels above regulatory limits. Pilot studies for other technologies to address both chemicals were unsuccessful. The record of decision for the site selected enhanced in situ bioremediation for TCE and fractured rock source areas. This approach included two rebound tests to verify asymptotic levels in source areas. A technology and feasibility waiver was selected for NDMA and fractured rock source areas, again, based on pilot study and site-specific investigation. Dissolved phase contamination in alluvial groundwater at the site was addressed by monitored natural attenuation for both TCE and NDMA. An enforceable environmental covenant for TCE and NDMA in alluvial groundwater prevented exposure to surface receptors. The remedial decision document also specified that the selected remedial approach would be reevaluated in 20 to 30 years. And that time frame was based on site conditions and contaminant behavior at the site. So in summary, we've reviewed the value of the written long-term management plan, and we've discussed the components of the site plans. We've described key considerations for monitoring and the role of scheduled performance evaluations. And then we discussed how to apply appropriate decision logic to performance evaluations in order to maintain remedial progress. Now we'd like to hand it back to Susan for our wrap-up and Q&A section. Susan, over to you.
Thank you, Sam. That pretty much concludes our training on remediation management of complex sites. In the training sections, what we covered was identifying technical and non-technical challenges at the site, using the remediation potential assessment as a potential site tool and decision-making tool, applying adaptive remedy selection and hopefully understanding how to take your site into long-term management. I think we have a final poll. Nicole, you bring it up. The poll question is whether you would recommend using adaptive site management at your sites. And I'm not sure I see the poll's answer. Oh, here we go. Thank you, Nicole. It looks like a lot of you, it looks like the majority of you would indeed do so. Which is great news for us and for ITRC. Looks like there's a few of you who may need to learn more about the technique, and that's clear and understandable. Here we go. So this training has highlighted some elements of the guidance document. And we're kind of hoping that this little taste of the guidance document will lead you to become more familiar with the guidance itself. If you do adopt the guidance or find that it's useful, we are hoping that you might be able to provide some feedback and some success stories to ITRC. The guidance will encourage you to, you know your site, your main takeaways, technical and the non-technical challenges, to assess the remediation potential at your site, to apply adaptive site management principles, and so importantly, get your stakeholders involved early and develop consensus-based interim objectives. And then also to schedule periodic evaluations of remedy performance to track remedy progress and to make improvements. Thank you for attending the training. And I'd like to turn it back to Nicole for Q&A.
Yeah, thanks, Susan. Appreciate it. And thank you, everybody, and all of our speakers throughout today's training. We will pause here just to do another Q&A break. So I would encourage if at this time you have any questions that you would like to ask of our trainers, please go ahead and use the Q&A pod window at the bottom of your Zoom screen. I will also note that if you need further clarification or you have additional questions after the training, you can feel free to email us at itrc@itrcweb.org, and we will get happy to get back in touch with any of our trainers. Just for question on Elizabeth, I believe this came in during your session, so you may want to come back in, but it was under an adaptive approach. Would a CERCLA site have to do multiple ROD amendments to document iterative remedial approaches or actions?
I'd be interested in Susan's input here and maybe Sam's as well, but I think that under the current guidelines, you would need to do multiple ROD or ESD amendments over time, just following the current EPA procedures.
I can tell you that that's been my experience in applying this at my complex site. That said, you know, we're doing this under a very old ROD that was written, you know, in the way that RODs were written in the mid 80s, which is, you know, very, very, very cut and dried. And so as a practical matter, when we have used this adaptive site management approach, you know, that practically that's how it's been done, is through ESD and ROD amendments. I guess I would like to envision the possibility of a ROD being written more flexibly in the way that we kind of described. I don't myself know of any. It seems like it would take a lot of great integrated stakeholder involvement to do that. And so as a practical matter, I think that the way this is generally done is through ROD amendments and ESDs, et cetera.
Yeah, I can chime in really quick, Susan. I actually have worked on a site in Region 8 EPA where we did just that. We were able to integrate an alternative remedy into the rod, which allowed us to, since it was already in the record of decision, it was no longer necessitated a rod amendment. ESD comes potentially if there is some significant difference that needs to be addressed, but it worked out really well to have the foresight to put into the record decision potential alternative remedies that were somewhat based on the approach that Sam talked about. You know, if we were proceeding along the remedy to a certain point and anticipated that that remedy would only get us to X cleanup level, that we would have the ability to switch over to a different technology or remedy approach. And just a heads up on that.
I would chime in, thanks Roy, that the Colorado site example that was on slide 90 really was somewhat of the type of rod that we're talking about, where we had good site knowledge, the regulators were on board with the site investigations, the team pretty much agreed in our conceptual site model, and we had confidence that we knew what the limits of the various applicable technologies were, so that when it came time to write the record of decision, you know, they granted a TI waiver for one chemical. We recognized that we have to live with asymptotic levels for the TCE, and then the management of the groundwater plume through an environmental covenant with an extended period of time to allow the site to mature and attenuate further represented an example where the site could be managed safely and still dial back on the intrusive remedial actions that weren't going to add materially to site safety. So, and we've looked at that approach at other sites. One was a state-led site in Arkansas a few years ago where we had similar flexibility in how we addressed managing contaminant in place. And so it really boils down to how well the particular site management team works together, including the regulators, because we have to follow the law, but when you have good technical understanding of the site, you can generally negotiate a bit more flexibility in how intensively you have to do the administrative documentation. Thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you to the person that posed the question. I always find it interesting when our panelists can all weigh in and add value to the conversation. So at this time, I am going to say thank you to not only our panelists, but our attendees. We are going to host the Remediation Management of Complex Sites webinar one more time live in the fall. If you enjoyed this and want to help us promote it, we will also be archiving this for on-demand listening. And we look forward to any additional questions or feedback from you later on. I have put the feedback form in the chat, and as I close the webinar window, you will also have access to it again. A reminder that filling out the feedback form and going to the bottom of the form and clicking the checkbox that you certify that you participated today will allow us to email you your certificate of completion after the class. Thank you, everybody. Have a wonderful day.